Wednesday, May 8th, and we're in full discussion regarding public hearing on House Bill 5031, Department of Ag Support Services. And before the committee leaves, Ms. Baker will talk to us about committee agenda, since some of the other committee members are not here. Are there some other things you'd like to say, Mrs. Baker, before we get started? So I'd like to invite the department, Mr. Paksharesh, Ms. Nelson, Ms. Baxter, whomever, how you have it arranged. So we see some people here from Affordable Health Care, so welcome to the hearing today.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members. Chair Boris Paksharesh, Chief Administrative Officer for Department of Human Services. Before I start the presentation for Admin Services, I just wanted to point out that in your books, in addition to the presentation material that we're going through, there is detailed information about every program within Admin Services. So there is much more information, given that we're not covering every office within Admin Services. There are more material there, and you know, if there are any questions, I'd certainly be glad here or afterward to answer those. So today, given that we're running behind the schedule, we have modified, this was the beginning of our presentation yesterday. So we're trying to wrap up 2 days' worth of presentations into 1 day, so we will not be going through every chart and every slide in detail, although the intent is to answer every question that you have. So, you know, I'd be glad to pause at any point and respond to any questions. So what we intend to do today, the high-level overview of AS would be, administrative services would be very brief, and we're going to be focusing on POTS and any other questions that you might have. We'll begin on page 38, which is has a listing of all of the offices within administrative services. And again, given that in the overview that we did several months back, we covered some of this material, I won't go through these charts in detail. Briefly, just go through chart 39, and you can see again a bunch of statistics reported there. Again, I will not go through that one by one, but that gives you a flavor of the kind of work that we do in administrative services and the volume of work that we handle. What I did want to mention before we go to the next chart is that, as I have mentioned before, and I think our director mentioned this in his opening statement, really what we are doing in administrative services and what we are trying to do is to provide an environment where we can, in the most efficient and effective way, provide these so-called shared services so that the program divisions can focus on their core areas of operations, which is really serving the clients. And in doing so, we are fully aware. Yesterday, you know, we talked a whole lot about waste in this process of lean. We are fully aware that every dollar that is wasted in administrative services is a dollar that's taken away from the program areas. And every dollar that is saved could potentially be a dollar that could go to serve our clients and really all Oregonians who we serve. So with that understanding in mind, what we have tried to do in admin services is to be focused, to provide the best services at the lowest cost. And in the past year, in the beginning of this year, we set out to focus on five areas in order to achieve those goals and mission. And I want to turn it over to Sue Nelson, who is our Deputy Chief Administrative Officer, to quickly cover those.
Before we start there, Mr. Paksharesh, what I'd like to do, $150 million is a lot of money. So I know that you're working on it with your new system of lean, but come back and be real specific in terms of how you're doing that And that's pretty overwhelming.
Madam Chair, that's why Tricia Baxter is here, and she will share with you what we are doing in the Office of Overpayment Recovery, Payment Accuracy and Recovery, and where does that $152 million come from. And in fact, part of our lean process is to try to take care of this process up front so that we would not make some of those overpayments, so that you don't have to go back and collect them. Again, you know, the process of reward.
Sure.
Thank you.
Chair Carter, members of the committee, my name is Sue Nelson. I'm the Deputy Chief Administrative Officer for DHS. I'm just going to very briefly, in the interest of time, go through our five areas of focus for the Offices of Administrative Services, and hope that you'll hear these names called out as you have throughout the presentation and in the remaining discussion of the POPs today. Among the five areas, looking at slide on page 40, is financial accountability and stewardship, management practices, customer service, leadership, and continuous improvement. So on the subsequent slides, starting on 41, I'll just call out a few of the items that we hope you'll hear. Under financial accountability and stewardship, looking at smart investments, consider the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery certainly to fall in that category, and Tricia will talk more with you about that. On page 42, focusing on management practices and specifically workforce management, we'll have a presentation a little bit later focusing on affirmative action, diversity, and cultural competency and our efforts in the department around those three areas. Slide 43, customer service, continually acquiring and responding to feedback from the people we serve in the department so they can better serve clients. On slide 44, under the
category. Can you just go back to affirmative action?
Absolutely.
And let me know what you're doing in that area, because when I go into, as I have looked at the director's office and his board of directors, I don't see diversity here. I want to know about what are you doing in terms of the workplace and your field offices for along the lines of affirmative action.
Chair Carter, with your permission, I'd like to defer that to when Louise Melton Breen, our Human Resources Administrator, comes
sure.
up to
okay.
focus on that item for
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Moving to page 44, under the category of leadership, one of our major accomplishments in administrative services over these last several months is to develop a strategic plan with performance measures and incorporating the core values of the department into each one of those plans.
Can I just interrupt you again?
Sure.
This is a good time, and thank you, Senator Morgan. I'd like to introduce my constituents from North Northeast Portland and members of ARP who are working on issues around issues of seniors and people with disabilities, and so I'd like to welcome you here to your state capitol today.
Thank you. And last but not least, continuous improvement. You've heard a lot about lean methodology and the work that we're doing in finance. The Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery is a part of that pilot project as well. Of course, we hope to roll that methodology out across the division and the department as a whole. So with that, I'll turn it over to Tricia to talk about financial accountability and stewardship and the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery and the associated POP.
Good afternoon, Chair Carter, members of the subcommittee. My name is Tricia Baxter. I'm the administrator for DHS's Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery. The Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery was established on July 1st of 2005, so we're a fairly new office at DHS. We were created by pulling different groups from throughout the agency that already existed but had a common theme around program integrity, payment accuracy, and recovery. We pulled them all together with the idea that by working together, we could further our work and be more successful in assuring program integrity and in improving payment accuracy and recovery. The office works in partnership not only with the other divisions within DHS, but also with our clients, with our providers, with other state agencies, with the federal government, with our managed care plans, and with private health insurers. All of this is done to ensure that the dollars that we have at DHS are going out appropriately and that we're recovering funds that have either gone out inappropriately or that at a later date can be collected back. On page 49, you'll see an organizational chart. This was put in here to give you an idea as to where the units that are part of the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery resided prior to the formation of the office. And as you can see here, it's color-coded, but some of these units were within the Children, Adults, and Families Division. One of them was formerly in the Seniors and People with Disabilities Division. A few of them were within our Financial Services Office within Administrative Services. And one of them was actually with the Director's Office, but prior to that was in the Division of Medical Assistance Programs. So as you can see, we really serve the entire agency, and we address all programs through this office. Moving to page 50, we do have a policy option package that we've submitted on behalf of the office, and this package does five key things for us. First of all, yesterday, Jim Scherzinger mentioned that the agency has 24 different financial and payment systems. That counted one of those 24 for the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery. However, within the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery, we have about 30 different standalone types of computer systems that we use to do our work. Some of these are core systems of the agency. We use the current MMIS system. We use systems that have been established long ago within the Children, Adults, and Families Division. Many of these are standalone spreadsheets and database applications that staff have on their computers at their desk that they're using to do their daily work. None of these systems talk to each other. So we have 11 units that are using 30 different systems, and one unit can't often see what the unit next door is doing on their cases. So a big portion of this policy option package is to provide funding to consolidate all of those systems into one core system for the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery and for some of the functions within the Office of Financial Services. This system would be an integrated system with other systems throughout the agency. It would link to the MMIS system when the new system comes on board, the new child welfare system that is in developmental stages now. Any systems that are out there that are issuing benefits or payments, our system would interface with so that we could have one system that our staff is using that will pull information from those various systems. We're in the very, very early planning stages for this at this point, really beginning to gather some business requirements. But before we do this, we're going through the lean process improvement methodology to make sure that our processes are good so we're not automating bad process. And we spoke a little bit to this yesterday. We're spending a lot of time ensuring that we have good processes, standardized processes throughout the office, and then we'll build a system that will support those processes.
One question. How do you coordinate information from those three systems in the course of any one day or the course of any week?
Chair Carter, that is a big problem for us currently. A lot of time, what we would call non-value-added time, is spent jumping from one system to another or making phone calls to get information that we're not able to access. So. Another piece of the policy option package involves funding for a variety of different positions. First on that list is to add five additional fraud investigators to be located throughout the state. With our current staffing in the fraud investigations unit, we are not able to keep up with the referrals that are coming in. We get referrals on fraud from the general public. We get referrals from branch staff. We get referrals from clients that see other clients doing bad things. We get referrals from providers as people arrive to get services and they see that something's a little off on this, perhaps. One example there was a dental office that called us and said, we just had someone come in and they presented their medical card and we gave them service. And we're comparing the x-rays to those of a few years ago, and this is not the same person. So someone had loaned their card to this individual. Fortunately, this person had a follow-up appointment to get some further work done, and we had them work with local law enforcement and actually came in and arrested the person for theft of services. So there's a lot of partnering, as I said, with the provider community, and that's one example in the area of fraud investigation that we had a very successful partnership. As I said, these investigators would be located throughout the state. We currently have investigators located statewide. We only have two on the eastern side of the state, and that's a lot of territory for two people to cover. So we haven't determined exactly where we'll place these positions if we're successful in obtaining them, but we'll look at workload and where the greatest need is and place those positions where we can utilize them the best. Additionally, this package would fund five limited duration positions for our overpayment writing unit, another area that a backlog exists. They get referrals from a number of sources to write up or bill an individual when an overpayment has been issued. At this time, there's a large backlog, greatly due to systems issues. And that's why we're only requesting these as limited duration positions, because we do feel that once the backlog is caught up, the new systems will allow us to stay current.
Madam Chair?
Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much. You have shared that you're adding, you're requesting additional fraud investigators because you're unable to keep up with the number of investigations. What kind of capacity will this give the agency? What difference do you anticipate as a result of getting the five permanent and the five limited duration staff people?
Chair Carter, Senator Gordley, right now we know that there are hundreds of cases per investigator that we're just not able to get to. The additional five investigators won't eliminate that, but it will bring us a long ways to catching up on those. Fraud investigations will always be needed. No matter how much work we do up front, we have to admit that fraud will always occur. But as I get further into this package, you'll see that we're also requesting positions to do some of that upfront work, to look at getting payment accuracy upfront, to look at methods to deter fraud upfront. So our hope is that by adding the five additional investigators, we'll be able to resolve that many more cases, bring a stop to different trends in fraud that occur. As we've noticed, there's things that communities of people that figure out a scam, and until they're caught, that continues. So the more people we have out there, the greater presence we can have in these communities, so that people are aware that there's an investigation function that occurs, the deterrent to fraud will be strengthened.
Follow-up, Madam Chair. Thank you. If you could tie the work of the investigators to the appropriate performance measures when we get to that place, or now, whatever works for your presentation.
Chair Carter, Senator Gordley, I'd be happy to do that, and we do have a performance measure that addresses the turnaround time on the fraud investigations.
Okay.
Additionally, as I mentioned, the policy option package requests some positions to look at policy and training issues for the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery. In this training, we're not looking at training of our own staff, but looking at developing data on overpayment trends, the types of errors that are occurring, and doing outreach and training to branch staff, to providers, to clients, looking at where the errors are occurring and providing that upfront education to try to minimize those errors. Our goal is to not have the overpayments coming from mistakes, but to have those overpayments, unfortunately, coming from fraudulent activity where we couldn't have prevented it necessarily up front. So long term, we would see that our overpayment writing function would decrease and our overpayment recovery function could decrease somewhat because we'll have payments being accurate up front. And this isn't just benefits to clients that we're talking about. It's also provider payments where providers are billing incorrectly. It's a very complex process that they have to use for billing. And we do provider audits. We look at billing practices and educating providers about the proper way to submit their billings. It's not always about fraud. It's often, and most often, about honest mistakes that are made. So we feel that we can really reduce the number of overpayments by some attention to the upfront part of the process.
Put a number to both of these last two in discussion. I see you say funding for positions, but you didn't say how many. So these last two that you're
speak into it.
Certainly, Chair Carter. The Policy and Training Unit, we're requesting 5 positions. 3 of those would be support, 2 of them being actual people that are going out and doing the training. The support would look at the types of overpayments, they would study the trends, they would pull training materials together, schedule trainings, and then the 2 policy analysts would actually go out and deliver that training jointly with some of our staff members that have expertise in the areas that we're doing the training. The final piece is for a data match unit. We've also requested 5 positions. 5 seems to be a common theme here. We have a number of data matches that occur within the agency around program integrity and payment accuracy. One of these matches that we're currently working on within the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery is called the Paris Match. It's a public assistance reporting information system match that matches our clients with those in other states. And if there's a match, it's an indication that something might be wrong. People should not be receiving benefits in 2 states at the same time. Currently, we're working that match, and we've seen some results off of that match, but we really don't have the resources to investigate the hits on these matches. That's one example of a match. We also have a match with the Employment Department, where quarterly we get wage information on our clients, and we match that with the wage information that the clients have reported to see if there's been an overpayment in their benefits because they've been making wages that were not reported by the client. There are a number of matches of that sort that we feel we are not paying enough attention to, and by staffing a unit to really embrace those matches and identify where there's an overpayment that's occurred and either shut down benefits or refer that to overpayment writing to develop an overpayment and collect those funds back.
Representative, the data match function, is there potential for that to be an automated function that doesn't require people?
Chair Carter, Representative Morgan, in many cases, yes. With better systems, we could automate portions of those matches. Unfortunately, because of the way the benefit system works and the timing on various matches, usually some sort of human intervention will be needed to get an accurate overpayment written. An example would be on the Employment Department match. We get data for a quarter, so that's for 3 months. That match does not tell us if it was the month of January, February, or March, for example, that the wages were earned. So we need to look further at that to find out when the wages were earned to see if there really was an overpayment, comparing that to when the benefits were issued.
Representative
Clark? Ms. Baxter, just to help put the fraud in perspective for me, can you assign a dollar total on an annual basis?
Chair Carter, Representative Gard, I don't have a dollar total specifically related to fraud, but I can tell you that I'm looking back at some work I did for Representative Nathanson earlier in the session. About 9% of our client overpayments are related to fraud, and they make up about 14% of our outstanding accounts receivable. Right now, the accounts receivable balance in our client area is $43 million. So about 14% of that $43 million is right now outstanding and uncollected fraud-related cases.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Further questions?
Okay. On page 51, we've got some historical information as well as our estimates for revenue to be generated this biennium and what we're estimating for next biennium. This policy option package will create a return on investment so that it will pretty much fund itself. I believe the final dollar amount of general fund requested came out to about $20,000. The rest of this would be funded through the recoveries that will increase as a result of these additional positions and the eventual system improvements. So on page 51, you can see our actual collections in the various units from 0305 to 0507, and then our current estimate for 0709. What I'd like to point out here is that not all of these collections, Chair Carter mentioned $152 million, that is a lot of overpayments. Not all of our collections are related to overpayments. In fact, only about 15% of them are related to overpayments. The first item on this, for example, is the Estate Administration Unit. in 0507, the estate administration unit makes up about 29% of our projected recoveries. This is a function where payments have been made completely accurately to a client. The client, after they pass away, their estate is responsible to reimburse the state of Oregon for any Medicaid expenditures. So we file a claim in the estate, and we are reimbursed to the extent that the estate has funds available. When clients sign up for services, they're made aware that this will happen. So those are not overpayments. Those are payments that have been made correctly. The state is entitled to collect them back at a later time. Another one that is similar to that is the personal injury liens unit. And although this is not a lot of dollars, this is a situation where one of our clients may have been involved in an automobile accident that was not their fault. They receive a settlement to pay for their injuries or for damages incurred in that accident. We can file a lien on that settlement and recover some of those funds that have been paid to them for medical if we have paid out medical services related to the accident. So to the extent that we've paid out funds related to injuries sustained in the accident, we can file a lien on a settlement. And there's been some changes due to some recent Supreme Court activity in that program, and that's why you'll see declining numbers in that particular program. But there is still some money to be recovered. Again, payments that have been made appropriately, but the state has an opportunity to recoup those funds later.
Madam Chair. Getting back to this whole thing of overpayment, you charge a rate of interest to people which you've overpaid?
Chair Carter, Representative Garrard, we do have authority under statute to charge interest. However, due to the clientele that we're usually dealing with, the mission of the department is to help people become independent, healthy, and safe. These people that we're issuing overpayments on have just gotten back on their feet, most of them. So we have chosen to not charge interest on the client-related overpayments because in many cases we're looking at payment plans of $10 to $15 a month. They would never be able to pay their debt back to the state. We try to do a very gentle collection process to bring the money back, but to not push the client back onto our programs again. We want them to maintain their independent status.
Okay.
Look at those badge frames.
That puts in my mind that you have to be in a very difficult position to balance compassion with good business practices.
Chair Carter, Representative Gore, that's very true. We have excellent revenue agents that do this work. They are very compassionate. Actually, I feel that everyone that works in the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery is very compassionate. The agency is about providing services to Oregonians. Our role in that is to bring these funds back into the system, bring them back into those programs so they can go back out the door to Oregonians that are still in need. But there is a very fine balance there. That's not to say that we don't use collection practices when people don't cooperate with us. We do issue warrants, and garnish wages. Sometimes that's what we have to do. Also, we have some people that are fully able to pay these debts back if they've obtained funds in error due to fraud. Some of these people have a lot of money, so we don't feel quite so bad for them. But those clients that have just gotten back on their feet, you bet, it's a balancing act, and we work very hard to keep them on their feet, not to force them back onto our programs, but at the same time hold them accountable for the overpayment.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can we go back to the portion of the overpayment that is attributable to fraud? Because I heard you say 9% of client overpayments are from fraud. So if I read page 51, 9% of the $17 million that you would collect would be attributable to fraud. Is that correct?
The fraud liabilities are actually collected in a unit called the Overpayment Recovery Unit, and that is the $17 million that's projected for 07-09. When I said 9% of overpayment cases, that's related to the number of actual accounts on the system. 14% of the outstanding dollars. So about 14% of the dollars in that $17 million that we're projecting would potentially be related to fraud. 9% of the actual cases. To give you a number there, we have about 61,000 accounts right now in our overpayment recovery unit, which is where the fraud cases would reside. About 9% of those 61,000 are related to fraud.
Thank you for that clarification. Follow-up? So I'm looking at the five permanent fraud investigators, and I'm not saying there's not fraud, and I think we have to have good stewardship of the money. But are they specifically going to be focused on the fraud aspect, and what's the cost benefit to spending the money on the five fraud investigators to recovering the money? I'm just wondering what those numbers are.
Chair Carter, Representative Kotek. The fraud investigators do resolve fraud investigations by telling us there's an overpayment here, but they do a number of other activities that bring payment program integrity into our programs. One of those in the food stamp program, for example, there may not be an overpayment that is cost-effective to actually pursue. However, they can shut down those benefits, saving the state money and not issuing those benefits any longer. In some situations, in many situations, there's a program called intentional program violation, where if the client agrees that, yes, I've gotten these funds that I shouldn't have gotten, I knew I shouldn't have gotten them, they sign a waiver. They are not allowed to be on the food stamp program for 12 months. If they do that a second time, there's an additional penalty. If they do that a third time, it's a permanent off the program penalty. So there's a deterrent effect. There's a cost avoidance piece that is big and hard to quantify, although I will tell you we're trying to quantify dollars related to those that don't result in the collection of an overpayment. Additionally, there does come a point. We've recently added staff to the overpayment recovery unit to do the collections work. We did receive through the emergency board, I believe it was, three additional positions to address that workload. Right now, we feel we're at a pretty good balance there. At some point, we'll reach the diminishing returns point. We'd like to build up those cases more before we add more on the collection end of things. So it could be that next session, we're back saying, well, now we've really beefed up this investigation effort, and we've gotten all these overpayments written, and we need some additional revenue agent help on the back end to collect these. At the same time, we would hope we can be reducing the other staff because we're improving our payment accuracy and deterring fraud up front.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair. And that final comment gets to kind of my concern is a lot of what we're dealing with is overpayment, not necessarily fraud. Mm-hmm. And I look at fraud as the IPVs, the intentional, mm-hmm. I didn't give you the right information, I'm getting money I shouldn't get. That's a small portion. To improve payment accuracy, getting back to process improvement, is how we're going to deal with the overpayment issue. And so it's getting a good handle of how many more investigators do you need and how many more people do we need in the process. And mm-hmm. so we don't need the investigators. So trying to get a handle on that.
Yeah, Chair Carter, Representative Kotek, those are the types of things that we expect to see through our process improvement efforts. Areas where we are understaffed and areas where after we make improvements or become more efficient or clear up backlogs, we can redeploy staff to those areas that we feel are the most impactful. The training up front is certainly an area where, you know, we'd like a whole lot more than five positions to do that work, but we do feel that as time goes on and we improve our processes, we'll be able to free up staff resources to be redeployed to other efforts.
Thank you.
Other questions?
Thank you. Moving on to page 52, we've provided some information here that just gives you a feel for what we've done as far as staffing increases and what the result of those increases have been. As I mentioned earlier, we did hire three revenue agents in July of 06, and we added a unit to the estate administration, or a team of people to the estate administration unit in April of 06. If you, and I'm sorry, these pages are a little out of order here. If you look to page 56, the first bullet there addresses those positions. When we requested those six positions, we had estimated that they would bring in an additional $4.92 million this biennium. As of the end of February, they had brought in $3.7 million, and it's anticipated that by the end of the biennium, that will be up to $5 million from adding those six positions. And they were not there for the entire biennium. Three of them were there for about a year, and the others were brought on shortly before that, about 15 months. And again, those, as Deborah just whispered in my ear, those funds that come back, we just want to reinforce, go right back into the program to go back out to clients that are in need. So these aren't funds that are just coming in and we're spending them willy-nilly. They go straight back to the program that they're collected in. So if we collect a food stamp overpayment, it goes right back to the food stamp program to provide more funding for food stamps. We also did a couple of pilot projects this year. One of them was to increase staffing in our medical payment recovery unit. The medical payment recovery unit deals with Medicaid claims that have been paid, and later we find out that the client had third-party insurance that should have paid that claim. The goal is for Medicaid to be the payer of last resort. So when we find out about those situations, the medical payment recovery unit goes in and collects from health insurance companies. Sometimes they're going back to the provider to recoup the funds if we find the provider has been paid twice, but they bring those funds back in. We did temporarily increase the staffing in that unit this year to work on a couple of projects. Those projects resulted, as of the end of March, in an additional $1.4 million. We had grossly underestimated what we thought we would find there. We had estimated $733,000 would come from those projects. And again, as of the end of March, they've generated $1.4 million. Additionally, we had new requirements, a new program from the federal government, Medicaid Part D, related to prescription drugs. One of our units deals with patients at our state institutions, the institutional revenue section. Because of the Part D Medicaid or Medicare process, we are able to now recoup some of the pharmacy expenditures at the Oregon State Hospital, both in Portland and the Eastern Oregon State Hospital over in Pendleton, and the State Hospital here in Salem. We're able to recoup some of the Part D funds that or funds that have gone out for prescriptions through Medicare Part D. At the time I wrote this information up, I had statistics through January that showed they had recovered $375,000. Now that's over $700,000. I just got another report yesterday. So, again, those are funds that the state has paid for these prescriptions, and we're able to then bill Medicare to be reimbursed for those prescriptions.
Madam Chair.
How
does that work with the clawback?
Senator Morissette, that is part of the clawback. So in my understanding, and I'm not an expert.
Okay, well, I guess the clawback is money that we have to pay the feds because of the savings on the dual eligibles that, you know, if they move from Medicaid to Medicare, then we have to pay the feds. Now, what you're saying is the program you just described brings money in.
Chair Carter, yes. Senator Morissette, you're right. I'm confusing the two. Clawback is separate. Part D is just related to prescription drugs.
Okay.
Clawback actually impacts our state administration unit, where we're able to claw back, reach back, and recover funds that we've paid out for the dual eligibles. It's not related necessarily to Part D.
Okay, I guess my question is, how much money have we had to pay the federal government because of that infamous clawback? And maybe you're not the one to answer.
Chair Carter, Senator Moore said, I'm probably not, but I'd be happy to find out who the right person is and get some information for you.
Okay.
Senator?
I'm suffering some confusion here, too. And the handout says Medicaid Part D. Is there, and I thought there was Medicare Part D, but I wasn't aware of is there a Medicaid Part D?
Chair Carter, Senator Bates, you're right, and I noticed that as I was looking here. That's a typographical error. It's Medicare Part D.
And then you get involved with clawback with dual eligibles, and that gets very complex. And the amount of money we've lost in that is always something that's been is up for debate now for some time. But I think John Britton is probably the staffer who can know more about it, could walk us through that if we need to. I have a hunch you're just one small piece of this.
I'm sure that I am, Senator Bates.
What a great catch, Senator.
Somebody else do it for you.
Let me ask you. We're not getting you two started. Why don't I ask you to just go directly to the workforce piece? And it seems like there's a lot of questions around that piece, and if they want to come back with some particular questions on this piece, I think that would be
interesting. Madam Chair, may we answer Senator Gordley's question?
Absolutely.
There was one question that you had asked around performance measures for fraud investigators. So, and with that, we'll move to the workforce piece.
So page 53 does outline the performance measures that we have established just within this last year for OPAR. We've got 12 of them, and we simply listed them here. We've given you two examples in the presentation material, and there are two more back behind the tab, Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery. Unfortunately, the one that directly relates to the fraud investigation function is the one... I have to look at my list here. Average length of time from acceptance of referral to resolution. The only unit that we have any data for on that measure is the fraud investigation unit. So, Senator Gordley, I'd be happy to provide you with a copy of that measure and the targets that we're hoping to achieve. And, again, it only speaks to the fraud investigations because that's the only unit that had data for us. Eventually, we'll expand that measure to be the entire office on overpayment referrals, fraud referrals, and other types of referrals.
Thank you. And then I believe you also, you were directing me to another tab. Is that the payments?
Yes, in the back of the book, the second to the last tab has everything you ever want to know about the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery. It actually has two additional performance measures that are not in the presentation. We have the percentage of claims requiring a TPR or third-party recovery billing, and we also have a performance measure around our collection rate, how effective we're being in collecting our accounts. So the two that we've put in the presentation document, the first one deals with the dollars recovered by the office, and again, I like to stress that those aren't necessarily overpayments. They're all types of recovery. The dollars recovered versus the dollars spent to support the office, and as you can see, we recover more dollars than we're spending on the office, and we expect that that will increase over time. And on page 55, we have the amount collected per full-time equivalent revenue agent. So these are revenue agents that are working on client collections. Over the fiscal year 06, they were averaging $71,000 per month per agent. And we do anticipate with our systems and process improvements that that will continue to increase.
Questions?
Get your question answered.
You did, thank you.
Okay. And with that, we'll move to DHS workforce presentation with Louis Meltengreen.
Thank you for your excellent presentation. You did very well.
I'll actually begin the presentation on the DHS workforce. We do have a couple of POPs related to criminal records, and we'll move through those quickly because I believe that you'd probably like to spend more time on our affirmative action, diversity, and cultural competency efforts. The first one, and I'll draw your attention to page 59 in your books, there's a pie chart that will give you some idea of the volume of criminal records checks that we process, and both the client populations and providers that are impacted by these. If you're wondering why this is under the category of DHS workforce, it is because we do consider this large provider groups an extension of our DHS workforce that serve providers. And although our criminal records unit is located in the Office of Human Resources, only 3% of the checks performed cover employees and volunteers. By far, most of the checks are for service providers. There's a bit of historical information on page 58. Essentially, the key date, I guess, would be 2001 when DHS experienced a reorganization. The various separate units in each division conducting criminal records checks were consolidated into one criminal records unit in order to maximize efficiencies, establish standard practices, and communicate across disciplines as these checks are performed. What remains outstanding from this consolidation are 11 standalone data and tracking systems that were never designed to interface. It's a theme you're probably finding familiar here. CRIMS, or the Criminal Records Information Management System, which is what the POP would fund, would create the integrated system. And some key things this will allow us to do differently is it will allow the unit to receive and process and respond and track requests electronically rather than by paper and fax, or mail and fax, which is how we do it now. It will enable us to interact with law enforcement through secure web interfaces and store the results, which we're actually required to do by statute. It will enable us to apply this across program disciplines in order to ensure that a person that we find to be unfit to serve one particular client population doesn't end up even temporarily serving an equally vulnerable client population due to our inability to share the information in a timely manner. It will improve our response time by completing most of the checks within a matter of hours rather than days. This is a huge benefit to our clients who are anxious to get a service provider on board, and a big benefit to the providers who are seeking to provide those services. It will reduce our backlogs and the associated overtime and temporary staff costs. And it will generate management reports that will be useful in identifying trends and managing the work through performance metrics. So the policy option package requests two full-time employees. One is a system developer, one is a system administrator. The rest of the funding would be used for limited duration staff, will be on board until completion of the project, and for the purchase of a system that we would hope to transfer into the department. So we believe this is a necessary and overdue action in keeping up with the goals of a consolidated criminal records unit within the department, and one that will significantly contribute to reducing risk and ensuring the safety of clients. Please answer any questions you might have or obtain any further information you might need to consider this request.
Questions, committee? Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm looking at the chart we have for POP 106-58 and notice that the general fund is 0.3 and federal fund is 0.3. And thinking about how the federal fund has been matched for cost recovery or whatever formula base we're using. On some others, the amount of federal funds available to match to state funds was a little bit more than the state funds. And then it was missing on the payment accuracy and recovery chart. It was a different ratio. And on this one, it looks like 1-to-1. So I'm kind of confused why instead of seeing a similar ratio, we're seeing it jump around and change.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, depending on what project you're involved in, the federal match shifts and changes. On this type of project, for this type of IP system, there's a standard 50-50 match. For example, for Medicaid, Medicaid Management Information System, because it is Medicaid fund, we get a 90-10 match. So for every $1, we get 9 in federal funds. On this project, the match is 50-50.
Good. Thank you. Thank you.
Chips, 72-28. Yeah. But I have a question that rises to the level of Senator Bates's earlier, scintillating observation. I see we've got general funds 0.3, federal funds 0.3 in the same package, and total funds 0.5. So that's a rounding error.
Yes, Mr. Chair, all the math is not my strong suit. I do know that 3 and 3 does not equal 5, and I apologize for the typographical error. It's 2.5 and 2.5 should be those figures.
Could you explain that to Senator Bates?
Certainly.
I just thought we were taking 100,000 home, Ben.
Yeah, exactly. I know where to spend it.
You had to bring it up in public.
Yeah, yeah.
Chair?
Yes.
I would like to ask a question real quickly. Just so I understand this package, this looks like a temporary package to make you more efficient. And you're gonna, and once you get the system in place with the new software and it's been trained on, then these two positions apparently go away, and those who are already doing the job now can do it more efficiently and more quickly. That's my understanding of reading this and what you just explained. Will it allow you to have a reduction in that staff size? That staff can be shifted to other areas where you might need them, and this is part of your continuing improvement process?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates, we do hope to apply all the lean methodology to this office as well. We have been focusing on business process improvement in this office before looking to a technology solution, so some of that work has been done. And we're always hoping for a reduction in resource in these centralized offices in order to apply that resource to direct client services as much as possible. Right now, so it's not to sound like we're going to conflict, because Louise in a moment is going to talk to you about another related POP that asks for more staff for this unit. But right now we have a lot of overtime, a lot of limited duration, and temporary staff to try to keep up on backlog. So at least initially we would hope this system would help us eliminate that.
And turnover, I'm assuming.
Yes.
And this isn't maybe as compelling or heartrending testimony, as we've obviously heard before this committee, but it's incredibly important testimony. I mean, it just gets down to the old adage about life. It's management, management, management. And so it's critical. And thank you for what you do. I believe Ms. Baker has a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to call members' attention to in the back of the document, there's an addendum one, and it has all of the numbers and all of the position counts associated with the policy option packages. So if you want real numbers and not the rounded numbers, they're back there for you.
Thank you, and I'll defer to Louise Melton Brain on the next pop.
Mr. Chair, members of the subcommittee, my name is Louise Melton Brain for the record, and I am the administrator for the Office of Human Resources. I'd like to direct your attention to page 62 and actually talk about the next policy option package, and it is associated with new federal law around the Adam Walsh Child Protection and Safety Act. And what this really does for us is it broadens our responsibility around background checks associated with foster and adoptive potential parents. Roughly at this point in time, we have approximately 2,000 criminal records checks that we run per month. Those currently do not all require a fingerprint-backed criminal record check, and this new federal legislation would require that for us. So this increases our workload within the criminal records unit by approximately 1,800 fingerprint-based checks per month. On page 63, we have the actual information on the POP itself, and I will direct you that the math does work in this particular slide. What we are asking for today is additional staffing for the unit, and what this would require is 3 new staff as of July of 07, and 2 additional staff to be phased in July of 08. And these staff are really going to help us with the actual workload itself. One of the other key components of this act is that we would actually be responsible for setting up a registry for folks within the system who have abuse or neglect substantiated cases. So we would actually be responsible for sharing this information with other states, and we would get information from other states on that as well. So at this point, if you have any questions about the POP, I would like to now kind of shift gears a little bit and turn your attention to page 66 and talk about our affirmative action goals and our plan for ongoing, which we have within the department. DHS is actually seen as a leader within state government around our activities for the percentage of women, people of color, and people with disabilities that we hire and retain. On page 67, you'll be able to see our actual numbers around people of color, salary range 24 and above, and we've also provided you with a comparison to state government as a whole. DHS is in that number for state government, but you're able to see us away from that number, but then also the state total. On page 68, we have a slide which illustrates our activities and our actual results for people with disabilities. And again, this is focusing on salary range 24 and above. Our goals for this next period.
Can you elaborate on what the salary range 24 is?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Boone, I would be happy to. Salary range 24 represents the first salary range for our management service positions, where we see managers who are actually overseeing the work of others. So this is really a critical breaking point for us, and it's where we actually see the middle management level, as far as this is the lower range, and then at approximately 28 to 29, we see where we start the middle range of management, and then we have another group which is the upper.
And I think, were you asking dollar amounts?
Oh, that'd be, if you know, I mean, it's okay.
Sure.
In that range,
I don't want to put you on the spot. Yeah.
approximately?
It's approximately $4,000 a month.
$4,000, okay, thank you.
And that would be the top of the salary range.
That's the 30 and above.
That would be 24 and above.
Oh, okay. Mr. Chairman?
Senator Gordon.
Thank you. It would be helpful to have actual numbers to go along with the percentages so that we have a more complete picture of what gains we're making. And then also, if you could disaggregate the people of color phrasing and break it down to race and ethnicity, so again we can gauge how much progress we're making in the different categories.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I'd be happy to provide that information. So on page 69, I want to just focus on where we are currently and our goals over the next biennium. And again, we're going to continue to work on increasing the number of people of color in upper and middle management positions and in the health and nurse professional areas, because this area continues to be a challenge for us. Included in this is also an emphasis on employment and retention of people with disabilities.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Gordon.
Thank you. Before you go on, I'd like to know how you're going to do that work. Can you speak to us about specific strategies that you will employ to achieve the goal focused on not just people of color, but also people with disabilities? How are you going to do that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I'd be happy to share some thoughts that we have around that, and I would like to actually have you turn to the next page, which is a good segue into where we are currently and some current work that we're working on. When it comes to affirmative action and efforts around cultural competency and diversity, it really needs to be a multifaceted strategy. And so when we look at this, it's recruitment, it's retention of staff, it's staff development, it's work around training and development in the area of cultural competency. And so we actually are engaging at this point in department-wide cultural competency training. And slide 70 actually illustrates what will be the outcome of that and our objectives for staff as they go through this training. But it's really our foundation for moving forward and being able to take this initiative to the next level. And I say initiative, it really is a department-wide program, and it's something that we really embrace when we look at our core values for the department. So it really is one where we continue to work across several different areas to do this work. And one of the key components of this is management accountability. It's making sure that managers have the tools to be able to do this work and that they understand what the department's goals and responsibilities are in the area of affirmative action, diversity, and cultural competency. It's providing them with the accountability to be able to move forward with their own goals and responsibilities around this area. And it's also having a performance evaluation system, which really has a key component where cultural competency is one of the competencies that we value as managers within the department.
And so, thank you. If I may follow up, are we to understand that the I'm going to call them activities on page 70 will result in you're being able to achieve the goals on page 69? Is that what you're saying? Again, I'm listening for specific strategies that will be employed to increase the representation of people of color and people with disabilities.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, it really is the foundation. And again, it's training and activities around recruitment and providing managers with tools to be able to move forward on actually helping us to achieve our department-wide goals.
And one last question. What kind of partnership do you have with the Governor's Office of Affirmative Action in establishing the goals, but also in defining the cultural competency training and how you're going to roll that out. Is there a partnership?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, yes, there is a partnership, and the Governor's Affirmative Action Officer has been engaged in reviewing and giving us feedback on the specific training, also in assisting us with our goals for this next biennium.
And I do have one last question. As you engage in this work, really important work, how are you sharing, or what structures are in place that allow you to share your learnings with other state agencies that are struggling and haven't made the gains that the Department of Human Services has made? Is there such a forum?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, yes, there is. There's several different forums where we are able to share information and our successes across state government. And one is a group that's specifically focused on affirmative action and diversity initiatives, which the Governor's Affirmative Action Officer is a part of. There's also another group at the statewide level where the administrators for the various human resource organizations get together, and then Fair Boards is also a member of a group where the administrative services officers also come together. And so we have a number of different ways where we share our ideas and successes so that we can build on the strengths of each other.
Mm-hmm. What can the legislature do? What kind of support do you need from this legislature around this initiative?
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, I think basically holding us accountable for really this whole presentation is about accountability, about plans, about the strategic direction, and then at the end about results. I think when you look at affirmative action, we're really focused on three different, when you look at this presentation, we're looking at three areas of focus. One is affirmative action, which is required by law. One is diversity, which is hiring the right mix of people into our department so that we can basically look like the population that we serve to the best of our ability. And the third piece, which I think is most important, is cultural competency. Because as all of you know, it's quite possible to have a very diverse workforce who are not culturally competent. Mm-hmm. So all those three areas become priorities for us. And as we go along this path, we're also learning from other state agencies. One of the things that we have done in our annual diversity conference that we have partnered with ODOT for really two reasons. One is to learn from one another, because ODOT is one of the biggest state agencies. And the second, of course, piece is to defer cost. And it has been very successful for the past 3 years, and we are intending to continue that partnership. And we're always open to ideas from other state agencies. Again, as Luis mentioned, we work very closely with the Governor's Affirmative Action Office. So what I would say is that basically our intent here is to present to you what activities we're engaged in. If you're seeing that we're not doing something or that we should be doing something better, certainly let us know. And you know, outside of this process, anytime, you know, calling myself or Luis or Sue would be more than glad to follow up. We do want to do the right thing. We don't always know the answers.
I appreciate your responses very much, and the quality of the responses, and would just also acknowledge the leadership of Dr. Goldberg in this area. He certainly is deeply committed, and that's what's required from all of our state agency leaders, that they demonstrate and speak the language of the commitment each and every day, and you can also bring that forward.
Thank you.
Thank you. Both of you, thank you.
Thank you.
If I could, I think Senator Gordley asked a very important question, and that was, what are you doing and what can we do to help assist you with other agencies, other departments, and coordinate these efforts? And as it related to, you know, relates to this committee and our work,
you know, certainly we need to ask that question, you know, in the service delivery section. You know, how can we better serve, better coordinate, break down the silo delivery system we've all been so hampered with for, you know, a number of biennium to provide better services. But it's equally important to ask, as Senator Gordley did, how can we, you know, better coordinate policies and values of this legislature and our society into these agencies, departments, and across them? I think that's an equally profound question, I think. I appreciate you asking that, Senator. Senator Bates.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to commend the department on this a little bit. At least you're asking the right question. You're showing numbers here that indicate you may well be above the natural population as far as cultural ethnicity is concerned, although I'd like to see a better breakdown as far as race is concerned. But in many agencies and government, we can get a number, and when you ask more questions about that number, you'll find that minorities are still underrepresented in anything above the minimum wage jobs or the very lowest echelon of jobs in the state, and that above that level there is a real problem. At least you're asking the right question, and I appreciate that. We're talking about management positions and upper management positions, and you admit also in the highest levels you're still concerned, and I appreciate that. And the question I'd like to know is, since other agencies don't seem to be able to even approach what you're doing, maybe you could at a later time share with us what you've done to make at least this much happen. Because we don't see this in every agency. And the numbers come to us in very strange and different ways. You have to kind of filter them through them, and what you find out is you've got 2 or 3% very low-level jobs, nothing above that, and yeah, we're going to work on it next year, we're going to work on it next year, we're going to work on it next year. But you seem to jump past this, so what I would ask for you to do for us is show us what policies you put in place at least to get to this level. I really appreciate it. I appreciate the fact you're asking the right questions here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Bates would be glad to do that. I just want to mention, and I think I have said this in front of this committee before, we do hold ourselves to higher standards. The fact that our agency is the biggest agency in the state gives us more flexibility to deal with these issues. You know, if you have an agency of 100 employees, it's really hard sometimes to hit the numbers. We practically serve every person in the state through our variety of programs that we have, including public health. So for that reason, we don't necessarily think that we should do the same or just a bit better than other state agencies. And we strive to do, to be as best as we can be. And I think we have a long way to go. We will admit that. But one of our goals, and I think around workforce, we didn't really have time to get to this today. One of our goals is to become the employer of choice. Mm-hmm. And to do that, you know, people of color, minorities, diverse population are looking. They know what good places are to work. And when they see that certain level of people come to our department, they ask why. If they see certain level of people leave the department, they ask why is that happening. So we are very aware of that. And unfortunately, in this presentation, we didn't have time to share with you some plans that we have around recruitment. So really, recruitment and retention become two pieces that work hand in hand, because it's equally important what practices we engage in to keep our best employees. I was talking to John Ramsey yesterday, and one of the things that he mentioned was that in Lockheed, as part of the Lean program, they paid three times the salary, amount of salary of some employees as bonuses to keep them. Well, we don't have that flexibility within the state system, so we have to be more creative. You know, how do we keep the talent, and how do we attract the right kind of people to come and work for us to really make this organization an employer of choice?
I'm sure you recycle.
You know, I think we're at a pretty good break point here because we've got IT tomorrow, and yes, let's not start that in the last 2 minutes. So, any further questions? I want to thank the panel, all the presenters today, for a very excellent job.
Thank you
very much. Oh, hold on.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I just wanted to call your attention. Tomorrow, in addition to wrapping up this part of the Department of Human Services, we will have a presentation on their program priorities and reduction options that they were required to present to the governor. There is also a work session on a federal grant application, and you have that material from John Britton in front of you. So that's for tomorrow. And the agency has provided some follow-up information on House Bill 2186, which you heard yesterday.
Thank you, Sheila. Anything for the good of the order? Thank you again very much. We are adjourned.